Welcome to the Black Sparrow Media Internet Broadcast Network.
You are listening to Linux in the Ham Shack. LHS is a podcast about Linux, open source, and amateur radio, for everyone. Now here are your hosts, Cheryl, W5MOO, Russ, K5TUX, and Bill, NE4RD.
Well, hello everybody and welcome. You have tuned in to episode number 539 of Linux in the Ham Shack. This is our weekender edition of the most terrific amateur radio podcast on the internet. This is the 115th edition of the weekender. We're glad you're here. It'll be hopefully an interesting night with some potentially interesting and potentially educational topic at the top, and then we'll dive on into hedonism, do the food, do the booze, and do all the fun things that make life worth living. But before we go ahead and get into all of that, we'll go ahead and introduce ourselves. I'm Russ, K5TUX.
I'm Cheryl, W5MOO.
And I'm Bill, and NE4RD.
I'm Bill, who forgot his call sign. All right.
Yeah. I was like, what?
Yeah, toward the end of the contest, I was starting to read off the call sign, and I said Alpha Fox Lima, and I couldn't even begin to imagine where that Lima came from. But
yes, that's contesting too. Eventually, your brain does get a mush, and you're like, oh no.
All right, so let's not divert into the CQWPX SSB contest, which happened this weekend. It was fun. I did enjoy it. I'm not a contester, but I made some contacts. So I guess that's kind of what it's all about. But what we do here on the... I said do-do.
Do-do.
On the show here, on the Weekender, we spin the magic topic wheel, and we find out what we're going to be talking about tonight. And here we go. And look, it's not making noise. well, I'll fix that in post. But anyway.
Bring, bring.
Oh, man. You know what? The world is against us. Because we've been talking about loggers for the longest time, and the topic it picked is logging best practices. I said no take backs this time, so I guess we're going to have to try and roll with it.
Well, we should be quite familiar with this.
With logging best practices? Yeah. So I guess we'll dive right in. Bill, what's the best practices in your logging artillery?
Well, I think it's not necessarily my artillery, but the best practices for logging is to have it replicated in multiple places. Because this will save your bacon when you lose one of the places, whether that be a hard backup, like you're backing up your .dot files or whatever to some other backup solution, or shipping your logs to Logbook of the World, EQSL, HRD log, one of the many different services that we talked about. Like, I think just distribution of your log is probably the number one best practice, is to not have it in just one place.
I certainly agree with that. Now, what do you if you're going to have your log in 1, 2, 3, 7 places, I'm currently logging to 6 different places, and if we consider like text copies of ADI files, then 7 different places. But I always have what I consider an authoritative log, the one that all the others are sort of replicated from. Do you consider that? Do you have like a central one and then you have copies of it, or do you feel like they should all be the source material?
Well, I mean, obviously I believe in having an authoritative logger locally as my primary logging operation. So I used to use CQR log, but now I'm using Qlog, as we've all learned in the latest episodes. I'd like having all of my log here, so I don't have to go try to rebuild it or reconstitute it or search from some other place. Especially because, like, you know, I might have my, well, I don't really bring my Shack computer remote, because when I'm remote, I run a separate logger anyway. So yeah, I don't know. I've always had it local. So I've always kept it local. I don't know if that's terribly important. I know we've talked to somebody that just logs it and sends it off the logbook of the world and chucks it.
Well, yeah, I don't know if I'd do that.
I'm not that kind of person. I kind of like having everything where I can see it. I mean, I'm a hoarder too when it comes to data. So, like, I have backups of probably the same thing from different computers multiple times on, you know, multi-terabyte storage arrays. So I like wasting space on stuff. So, I mean, it might just be my particular data practice when it comes to doing that leaks into my usage of logging programs in that way, where I want to have the local copy. I always want to have backups locally as well. I mean, when I exit out of the program, I want it to back itself up. As well, I'll replicate it onto another machine, you know, syncing my dot files.
So I guess let me ask you this question, and I have an answer for this question. I'll see what your answer is. So let's say, you know, you have your log stored in 4, 5, whatever, different places. Let's say for whatever reason you have to log, like, on paper. So where does that data go first? And if one of your other logs got corrupted, for example, where would you pull the data from? Which would be the thing that would sort of be the thing you created the data from, and is the thing that you baseline all your other copies off of, if you have one?
So I've always had backups. So I do ADIF dumps of my log regularly, and those are backed up to external places. So I would normally just restore a log from that point. I have done paper log entries before, because, like, when I go on the road and I actually have a radio in the car, I'll log the HF contacts from the car on paper, and then I'll come back later and just type them into my logging program, which then I'll sync to all the services. But if I were to have to restore, which I have had to do, I had to restore a log before while I was actively making new logs using, you know, WSJTX, which has a log built in as well. So I was able to catch my restored log back up using the ADA from the application that I was generating logs from. And that'll probably be, like, a really common occurrence. If there's going to be a problem, it'll be when I'm bringing a log to the computer to put it into the main logger. You know, if the computer dies or something stupid like that, you know, I'm bringing a log to it, most likely from, you know, a contest logger or away logger, or some paper logger, whatever. And then I would get that log back working. I would put that log into there, so import it into there, and then again sync it to all the external services. I think at some point I did have to pull down my log from somewhere, because I lost some log entries. But I was able to pull down confirmed contacts from Logbook of the World, and that actually filled in, like, I had a gap in one of my backups. So I was missing some logs. So I pulled just back in just confirmed log stuff.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. So I, you know, Grid Tracker, which I use a lot, has its own logger, but of course it only logs for FT8 and weak signal stuff, because it's connected into, well, it would do more. It depends on what you have throwing data at it. But the only thing I have throwing data at it is JTDX. So the only stuff that goes into there is the stuff that comes out of JTDX, but it logs to everything else. But I use CloudLog as sort of like my authoritative, because when I do normal QSO logging that's not FT8, I always enter it into CloudLog first. And then if there's anything that needs to be manually adjusted, like anything that's not weak signal, it is a copy from there. So hopefully everything is in sync, because I use, let's see, what do I use? I use CloudLog, of course. I've got the Grid Tracker log. I've got the text log, you know, the ADI file backups. I also have everything copied to QRZ, ClubLog, HRD, or HamLog, or Ham365, whatever it's called now, and of course Logbook of the World. So I'm hoping all of that stuff is in sync and I haven't screwed something up. But if I were to say that something got out of sync, my CloudLog would be the thing I would recover it from. So I think it is a good idea to have something, one place that you would use to recover everything. If CloudLog went away, it wouldn't really be that big an issue for me because I have ADIF dumps out of CloudLog, so I can rebuild everything pretty easy. Wasn't always the case.
Are you sending everything to CloudLog, and then CloudLog is sending everything to the third parties?
No. CloudLog integrates with EQSL. Oh, I missed EQSL. There's another one. CloudLog integrates with EQSL, CloudLog, I think, and Logbook of the World. And GridTracker does all of them. But of course, that's only for JTDX. So if I log something into CloudLog, I have to dump out of CloudLog and upload to all the other places.
Oh, okay. So you don't have a case where you have to go into CloudLog and say, well, don't do the FT8 contacts because that's already done somewhere else.
Right. Well, I don't log FT8 contacts in CloudLog. GridTracker does that part for me, so I don't have to worry about that.
Oh, and it flags the Logbook of the World bit for you?
Yes.
Oh, okay, cool. Well, I was just wondering if you happen to have a collision problem at some point where this one doesn't know what this one already sent.
The only thing that's really ever out of sync is GridTracker, because GridTracker will not have any non-JTDX contacts unless I put them in there.
So I think Adam has a question in the chat room. Do you consider services which primarily exist for confirmation matching, like Logbook of the World or EQSL, to be viable backups of a log? Yeah.
I do. Yes, absolutely. I mean, they store all your log data. So, I mean, and all of them give you the ability to dump your log data out. So, yeah. Yes.
Now, some people trust them more than others. So, I mean, you know, it's as good as anything else that you don't personally take care of the backups of. So you do have to kind of just assume that everything's being stored and backed up properly, and that they're not going to get attacked like, you know, United Healthcare got attacked and right. Lose all their data, because I'm sure the ARRL won't shell out, you know, millions of shekels for unencrypting all of their lost data when it comes to logs. So, I mean, do keep that in mind if you send your stuff to Logbook of the World and never see it again.
Yeah, and I will say, to answer that question more specifically, at least from my perspective, I would consider all of those to be viable backups of a log. I would not consider any of them to be a viable primary storage for a log. I would want something local that was in my control to be the primary. And if I had to recreate a log, it would be something that I made, not something that was stored in the cloud somewhere.
Right, yeah, the log matching services don't store everything in the log, so it's not critical for the matching process. So that's true, as Steve is saying in the chat room. So yeah, you will lose some description information in the log, and you may also have issues with, like I have had this before, where I'm importing stuff that was less than adequate for information. And then I had QRZ set up to update the location of the contacts. Well, that works all fine and good, except for, you know, stations that are not where they're normally at or not where they're living at, as in like mobile rovers and stuff like that, people on satellites. So you do have to be really careful about trying to restore your log from these services and then have some kind of fancy setup in your logger that says, hey, update all the information so I can have all their name and address and everything else in there. That will destroy the value of your log for sure. And I have done that accidentally once, but I just went backwards and redid it again.
I will say that I'm not sure about all of them, but as far as I can tell, QRZ stores every field you throw at it. So that might be considered a decent backup.
Well, I can't even get my log to go there. Well, I did an ADEF dump to him.
Right.
But I can't get the individual logs to go there, so we'll see.
Yeah, that's the thing with the API. And we were talking about that the other day. But yeah, I basically just do ADEF imports into QRZ. And as far as I can tell, everything, including, you know, the distance information that I throw in, the notes field, the comments, the names, and everything, as far as I can tell, it's all queryable in QRZ. I think it's all there. I can't verify that for ham365/HRD log or club log or any of those. I haven't checked, but I believe QRZ does have a full accounting of all the ADIF data you give it.
Which would make sense. I mean, you know, they should be building a storage system based upon the spec of the ADIF file, which should allow dynamic tags and stuff like that, or, you know, tags that are known to be in use
A cloud log has a bunch of stuff internal to it, stuff like it has fields for renting SOTA data, POTA data, IOTA data, stuff like that. I don't know if that stuff gets thrown into QRZ or not. I mean, there's certainly things that it could be storing that I'm sure get dumped out into the ADI file. But of course, whatever you're sending it to only reads in what it wants to read in. I mean, ADIFs are pretty free form, but the parsers only parse out what they want to parse. So you can put in, you know, esoteric fields, but not everything will ingest them, as is the case with like EQSL and Logbook of the World and stuff like that. So,
well, I think we got the distribution side of best practices for logging taken care of.
I think the best practice other than that is just to log. Make sure you log.
Yeah, log it all. Log it all. Except for repeater contacts. I mean, that's not, you know.
Yeah, no one does that anymore anyway. But if for no other reason than the data mining and the award tracking is just really neat.
Yeah, yeah, that's very true. It's very interesting stuff to look at. If you can isolate like the repeater contacts, or even like, I'm not just saying, you know, regular terrestrial repeaters, but like, you know, also digital stuff like you know, D-Star and DMR and stuff like that. Because I mean, you can have DX contacts in that maybe you want to keep track of or whatever, but don't necessarily get, you know, in the same status as awarded and stuff like that. But it's still interesting to, you know, track those conversations. Should you like, you know, want to work that person again, you can remember like which reflector you were on and everything else. You know, it could be useful to log that stuff, but I would probably keep it isolated to a location that doesn't sync, like one of those profiles that we talked about in, you know, the various programs and loggers out there. So it doesn't interact with anything.
Yeah, I do just like to scan through my logs sometimes. I know we were having a conversation the other day about like, have I ever contacted, I don't know, such and so DXCC entity, because you were trying to work them. It was there was a contact in Iceland, and then there was a contact somewhere else. And yeah, I was able to go back and say, oh yeah, yeah, I worked them on 15 and 17, you know, 3 months ago or whatever. It's cool. I like being able to do that.
Yeah, and it's easy to do it. And if you have a, you know, your log there, you don't have to log into something else out in wherever land that you don't control. And then like, oh yeah, I gotta remember how to query my contact on Logbook of the World or whatever. And then, you know, sometimes you have to remember, oh, it might not be confirmed, so it'll be just a QSL, not a QSO or whatever, because I have those two different designations. So yeah.
I will log something. I will log like simplex VHF and UHF, especially if it's like a tropoducting kind of thing where you're hearing a, you know, station 1,000 miles away on your on your 2 meter rig, that kind of thing. I've logged those before, but yeah, straight up repeater contacts, no, not done that.
Let's see here. And Adam says QRZ has a repeater as a propagation mode, which should exclude contacts from awards. So maybe that's a thing. I've just never used that. And of course, Steve says you only log stuff that counts towards awards because, you know, it's not points. It doesn't count. It's not worth doing.
Well, I don't know about that because I'm not really interested in awards, but I do like to log stuff. I do like to see where my signal has been heard. Especially since I don't run power, I don't have a fancy antenna array or anything like that. So anywhere that my signal has been, I find really, really cool. So especially if it's in those places where you stumble across the de-expeditions or whatever, and you get that that contact in Benin, and you're like, oh wow, that's really cool, 100 watts got from here to, you know, Southwest Africa and stuff, and then you can look back and say, yeah, I did that.
Yeah, I mean, that's what like PSK Reporter and stuff like that's for too, right? So you can kind of see like, oh, there's somebody hearing me over there. There's somebody who's got a radio turned on, but they're not answering. They're not playing radio.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I mean, best practices is basically just get all the information you need. I would say if you're going to do contest logging, two things I guess I will say I wish I had when I was doing the contest this past weekend is a foot switch and a headset. Those would come in really handy.
And a separate room far, far away from the house so Cheryl didn't have to listen to it.
Exactly. But freeing up my hands would have made logging a whole lot easier. I will say that. But not 1mm does actually make logging pretty easy, even if you have to use one hand to do it. So But yeah, just log. Make sure you keep backups of your log. Keep your data. It's really great for data mining, looking over your history as a ham. And otherwise, just kind of enjoy the hobby. That's where I'd say we leave it.
Yeah, it sounds like a good place to leave it.
All right, very good. Well, thanks for the chit-chat in the chat there. That actually made the topic really interesting. I appreciate that. And we're going to go ahead and get into some hedonism. So we'll bring Cheryl back into the show here. Because as far as I know, she hasn't done it. Well, no. You did do some logging. You logged for me when we were running Route 66 a few years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's that. That was just once. A one-off.
It was a one-off, and it was difficult because I'm trying to keep up with you, and there's people talking to me while I was trying to do it, because where we were at was a tourist stop for Route 66.
Yeah.
And there were several groups that came through, and they're like, oh, what are you doing? And I'm trying to keep up with everything that's going on and not be rude to them. So that was not a fun experience for me. So.
Oh, well, yeah, we got through it anyway. All right. So what do we got? Since we're doing food, food, everybody's got to eat kind of thing. I'm still stuffed from our Easter brunch, but, let's talk some more food, I guess.
Okay. Well, I fixed this a couple of weeks ago, and this has been the semi-regular dinner rotation over the years for us. It's called chicken a la mayo, and it's something different to do with chicken. The mayo keeps it moist, and instead of using breadcrumbs with it, you use cornflake crumbs. And sometimes I will make up a sauce for it. It's really good with a Dijon sauce. Russ does not like that, though. So it's fine just all by itself, too. Or maybe Thai chili sauce or something like that, something different. So for this, you need chicken breast, mayonnaise, dill weed, garlic powder, black pepper, seasoned salt, lemon juice, and some cornflake cereal. And the rest of the instructions will be in the show notes. And for my mixed drink corner, I picked ranch water, which is a very light cocktail that's low in sugar, but high in taste. This has crushed ice, lime juice, tequila blanco, sparkling mineral water like Topo Chico, and some lime wheels and some straws for serving. And that's, toss everything in a glass and there you go. You're all set and ready to go. Have a nice drink. So
You can have that while you're making your chicken a la mayo, I guess.
Exactly. So,
well, if you don't want ranch water while you're making your chicken a la mayo, you might have a glass of what I'm reviewing tonight, which is Duke Grand Cru Founders Reserve Bourbon. We had a taste of this in Kansas City several months ago. It took us a little while to actually find it. It's a limited release bottle, but at least a couple of months ago or back around Christmas, it was available in Kansas City's Total Wine. So we picked up a bottle there, and I see that it is still available from some online retailers. So it is still possible to get it if you want to get it. So let me read the descriptions I found of it here. Duke Grand Cru Founders Reserve Bourbon Whiskey is a symphony of this is going to be like the S36S or whatever it is, with all the superlatives, but you know how it goes. Bourbon whiskey is a symphony of unparalleled richness and exclusivity. This exclusive, see, they've already repeated themselves. The exclusive release, a tribute to the founder's legacy. The founder, by the way, is the Duke, which is John Wayne. Showcases the finest aged bourbons, imparting a complexity that lingers on the palate. With only a limited number of bottles available, each sip becomes an extraordinary journey, a rare indulgence for discerning connoisseurs seeking the pinnacle of bourbon craftsmanship and an unparalleled expression of time, passion, and dedication. It's all BS. It's readily available and on the shelf. Duke Grand Cru Founders Reserve Bourbon exquisitely marries the classic and bold flavors of our Kentucky straight bourbon with the finest French oak Grand Cru wine barrels in the world. A rare 9-year-old selection of our Kentucky straight bourbon is then aged in the same barrels that house stunning 98 to 100 point single vineyard California cult cabernets. The French oak originating from centuries-old forests and the perfect level of toasting ultimately provides a profound and unique expression of the spirit. Okay, so now after you've had your hip waders on and waded through all that BS, it's a bourbon. Interestingly, one of the requirements of bourbon is that it be at least 51% corn. Generally speaking, bourbons have more corn than that. That's just sort of the minimum. This one, however, goes for the minimum. From what I can find, and I'm going to take this a little bit with a grain of salt, because it might be one of those ones where people are kind of guessing at the mash bill. But I did find one place that said it was 51% corn, 39% rye, and 10% malted barley. So that's a pretty high rye bourbon. Along the lines of things like Blanton's and other things of that ilk, which have high rye content. Interestingly for me, I don't particularly like high rye bourbons, generally speaking, but the French oak barrels sort of tame it. So in this case, I do actually like this quite a lot. It comes out of Owensboro, Kentucky. The proof on this particular Duke version is 110 or 55% ABV. It's a light honey color, which is surprising because of the fact that it's a 9-year-old bourbon. It seems like it would be darker, but it's not. The nose on it is pretty straight bourbon, vanilla, caramel, toasted oak, and I get a little bit of salt air, a nice sort of like crisp aromatic salt air with a touch of literal saltiness. On the taste, I get lots of oak, subtle wine influence. You can definitely taste the French oak barrel in there from those Cabernets, those highly rated Cabernets. You also get standard bourbon stuff like caramel. I put oak twice. Let's take the extra oak out of there. Salted caramel and raisins. I think the raisin-esque thing comes from the wine barrel influence. The finish on it is medium or to medium long with hints of dried fruit, oak, caramel, vanilla, spelled correctly, and wine tannin. And one thing I did notice about this is the longer it sits in the glass, the better it gets. It seems to be kind of tight when it's straight out of the bottle, but as it opens, all the flavors really, really come out and give you a good punch. And that's good because this is not a cheap bourbon. It runs right in the neighborhood of $120 a bottle. So if you're spending $120 on a whiskey, you kind of want it to taste good. And I will say that this really does taste good. I really enjoy it a lot. I do like to let it sit and warm and air. I don't decant it or anything like that, but it could probably stand some. It's really good. It's really flavorful. All the essences sort of meld together really well. And I'd say it's a pretty good bourbon. I don't think it's quite worth $120, but I do have a bottle of it, so it's worth having it at least once, I guess. And I'm going to give this a rating of 92. I think it's really good. I think you can get better for less, but I enjoy it, and I'm going to enjoy it as I continue to drink it. So that's the Duke Grand Cru Founders Reserve Bourbon.
Nice. Well, mine's, so what do you got? Mine's not as exciting, and it's definitely cheaper. this is the Francis Ford Coppola Diamond Collection Prosecco. Normally not a big fan of Proseccos, but we're having ham today for lunch, and because it's Easter, and this is it was not too bad, surprisingly. Here's from the website. It's crafted from grapes from northeastern Italy with flavors of apple, citrus, and white peach. Introducing a sparkling new member of the Diamond Collection, the Diamond Prosecco, imported directly from the Prosecco DOC in Italy. The Francis Coppola Diamond Collection Prosecco is crafted from select grapes. Oh, well, it's basically the same thing. Between the Adriatic Sea and the Dolomite Mountains. Enjoy on its own with a meal or as an aperitif. Salut to every day. And this is 11% ABV, and the bottle's, you know, it's between $12 and $19, depending upon where you pick it up from. It would probably make a great mimosa. Definitely not... would not be horrible for that, but surprisingly it was not bad by itself. The bottle's completely gone, so it was done drunk, but you know, it is a bubbly, so you sort of want to get rid of it. I do have one of those stopper thingies for it, but you know, still you should finish the bottle. But yeah, it was pretty good. I would probably have that again if I wanted Prosecco or a mimosa day. So yeah, Francis Ford Coppola Diamond Collection Prosecco.
You could also use it for like peach Bellinis.
Sure, I don't know what that is, but you know, yeah,
it's a peach drink that uses Prosecco, basically.
Yeah, you use like a sparkling peach nectar, fizz
kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I mean, if you want a Prosecco that is already starting in at least the decent area of taste. You don't have to worry about masking it up with a bunch of other stuff. I think this one does stand up quite well among many, many others, especially in this price range that would fit the bill.
All right, very good. So that's really all we have in the way of hedonism, but we do have a little bit left of the show. The first thing we have is announcements and feedback. We don't actually have any announcements except for I hope we see everybody in Xenia in a couple of, well, it's what, 6 weeks now. So yeah, coming up pretty quick. So looking forward to that. And then I noticed I don't really pay attention to Twitter all that much anymore these days. But as it happens, we got some feedback via Twitter that I missed from the last Weekender. And this is from at Wade N-I-E, whatever. He says, regarding call sign prefixes for the U.S. and Canada reciprocal agreements, back when Canada and the U.S., back when Canada and the U.S., the reciprocal agreement predates SEPT and is required instead. In this case, the location is a suffix only, and the suffixes are mandated usually the original W number and VE number, but there are exceptions. So, if you recall back to our discussion of suffixes and prefixes, that's Wade's input. So,
oh, yeah, because we talked about the SEPT and you lead with your DXCC prefix.
Right.
So, Papa Julius,
Right. He says that for operating in Canada, we would do stroke VE0 or whatever because it's an agreement before SEPT. So,
and that's why the VEs use their VE calls stroke W1, stroke W2.
Right.
Yeah. So, a little different. A little different way, but yeah. That's why it's probably confusing because you hear, you hear it probably more frequently between Canada and US than you do, you know, other stations because normally, well, normally you get a special call sign when you're doing something special and fancy over in another country.
Right, absolutely. So, all right, well, then we'll bring Cheryl back in here to wrap up with our social media roundup that we don't call it that anymore, but go ahead and tell us who joined us on the social media platforms.
Okay, well, we did not have any new subscribers or Patreons this time, but we did have Alfonso Octavio, Araya Flores, and Zachary Terwillinger, and seven other miscellaneous people on Facebook. Twitter, we had at Mythic Bison, Instagram, we didn't have anybody. Mastodon, we had at IsPoDef. Nobody on the mailing list. On Discord, we had KQ4PVF, Tizenduce, and Radio.Norbear. On YouTube, we had Glenn Stewart and Ken Charlton. And on the live chat this week, we have Tony K4XSS, Jill K1TTZ, Steve KJ5T, Don KB2YSI, Mike K6GTE, Steve KA7HBT, Adam K3CAN, David KQ4PVP, and Ted WA0EIR.
David is KQ4PVF.
Yeah. Yeah, for some reason, my font size on the Etherpad was at 85%. Oh, yeah, now that I changed that, I can read it. Wow.
You're winging it.
Yeah.
Well, very good. You got through it, even though you couldn't actually see the text. So,
yeah,
excellent.
What happened?
All right. All's memorized.
Yeah. I don't know. The KQ4PVF is kind of a tough one. That'd be a little fun on CW as well. So I hope that one shows up in Morsel sometime. Yeah, lots of DAWs. So anyway, that brings us down to the end of the show. We really appreciate you being here, listening to the show, whether you're here as a live participant or you download the show afterwards and listen to it then. If we didn't do that, then we wouldn't be here making the show. So thanks, everybody, for listening, and hope you have a great week. Hope you have a great rest of your day or night or whatever it is while you're listening to this. And we also hope you'll join us in a week's time for our next deep dive episode. We're looking forward to get to that, and we hope you'll find it entertaining and interesting and maybe even learn a little something. So with that, we're going to get on out of here. We'll let you get back to whatever you're doing. Hope to see you soon. Take care. And this has been episode number 539, the 115th edition of The Weekender. And I'm Ross, K5TUX.
I'm Cheryl, W5MOO.
And I'm Bill, NE4RD, and I'm going to mess up my call sign again. 73.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Linux in the Ham Shack. LHS is a community-sponsored podcast. Live recordings are Sunday nights at 8 o'clock Central Time. Our homepage can be found at lhspodcast.info. You can support the podcast via Patreon at patreon.com/LHS podcast. We're also on Discord, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Mastodon. Contact us via email at info@lhspodcast.info or via voicemail at 1-909-547-7469. That's 1-909-LHS-SHOW. We also have merch. So until next we meet, remember to always heed your hedonism.